America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
Well, there's a lot going on in the Senate right now, and it's amazing how the Republicans are getting away with it again. I want to tell you about that briefly. And then the question I really want to get into is, who's really exploiting children in America? Is it CBS with Kid Nation, or is it the Republican Party? Consider that one for a moment. First, just a quick side note or what. 56-43 vote. The Senate actually, would have passed legislation to restore habeas corpus. But because it was four votes short of the 60 needed to stop a Republican filibuster, it didn't pass. Why don't the Democrats, this is the second piece of legislation in 2 days, where the majority of the members of the Senate, which included some Republicans, said, yes, we'll vote for this. And the Republicans, but the Republicans said, no, we're going to filibuster. And the Democrats said, okay, fine, we'll just stop right now. Instead of saying, okay, if you want to filibuster, then you should do it the way like in the good old days, when the senators would stand and talk for 15, 20 hours. I mean, if you're going to have a filibuster, have a filibuster. In any case, obviously all the Democrats are on board to bring back habeas corpus. The Republicans opposed to it. It's fairly clear, I think, who really values American values. I mean, habeas corpus, the right to face your accuser, the right to know what the charges are against you, the right not to be imprisoned without being charged with a crime. That's what habeas corpus is. This is a right that goes back to 1215, the lords, I guess, the nobles in England forced King John on the field in Runnymede to sign the Magna Carta. It started in 1215. This has been a cornerstone right of Western civilization for 800 years. And the Republicans did away with it in the last legislative session when they controlled Congress. And now when the Democrats try to bring it back, the Republicans say, no, we're going to filibuster this. We're going to prevent it from coming to a vote. And the Democrats could only pull together 56 votes. They need 60. There's 100 senators. And they should fight this thing tooth and nail. They absolutely should fight it tooth and nail. But frankly, it doesn't look like they're going to. All the more the shame. The fall TV season is cranking up. Tonight, CBS Kid Nation. Everybody is hysterical about this. I don't get this. LA Weekly, Nikki Fink writing about Les Moonves, a mogul with no conscience. Sure, it says that fall television season sneaks up on us. All anyone is talking about is CBS's highly promoted Kid Nation. I see this as an extraordinary opportunity, a teaching moment for progressives, for Democrats, for Americans, for people who are concerned about American values and the things that America stands for, to deliver a message to America broadly about what we really do stand for. Here we have, and it's really interesting how the whole, this whole media machine now has cranked into this. Oh, this is a terrible thing. These 40 kids are going to be confined to a ghost town for 40 days in New Mexico and 40 nights. These 10, 11-year-old kids, they're working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is a violation of the labor laws, child labor laws, even adult labor laws. They're only paid $5,000. Although during each episode, one child is selected to be awarded with a gold star worth $20,000. So they can make some money. They all are going to have an opportunity, presumably, to have, as is so often the case in reality shows, lots of opportunities open up that wouldn't be there otherwise. No doubt behind every one of these kids is the equivalent of the old cliche of a stage mom or dad, pushing them along and saying, yeah, this is great. Hey, my kid's on TV. And yet the discussion in the media, and here's what's so weird about this, the discussion in the media is all about the exploitation of children. And the example being used is Kid Nation. Now, I think, frankly, the reason why is because the more publicity CBS can get for this, the more money they'll make on it, the more people who will tune into it. And isn't it a wonderful thing? And they love the controversy. But I want to take it to the next step. Rather than promoting this TV show, the question I'd like to ask is, if we're so concerned in America, if we as Americans, as good Americans who believe in the values of this country, the values on which this country was founded, if we're so concerned about these 40 kids ages 8 to 15 who are in this TV show, which from this point forward I'm not even going to name, if we're so concerned about them, why aren't we concerned about the fact that 35.5 million people in the United States live below the poverty line? 12.9 million of them are children. Why are we not concerned about the fact that 3.5% of all U.S. households, now 300 million people in the United States, roughly 150 million households, or I think it's 117 million households in the United States, so 3.5%, that would be somewhere in the neighborhood of around 5 million people, experience hunger. Hunger. The people in these households frequently skip meals, sometimes going without food for an entire day. 9.6 million people in America, including 3 million children, live in these homes. It's not like it's a secret. I mean, there's a number of agencies out there that are talking about it. Bread.org, the Bread for the World Institute, has some, you know, great information you can find over at their website. I mean, the basic details about 35.9 million people in America living below the poverty line, that's from census.gov, the Bush administration, the federal government's, you know, the statistics, it's right there. America's Second Harvest, secondharvest.org. It's the nation's largest network of food banks. They report that from the last years of the Clinton administration to the first years of the Bush administration, 23.3 million people came to their various food banks around the country. 23.3 million people. This is an increase of over 2 million since 1997. These are statistics as of 2001. 40%, by the way, of these people who are going to food banks looking for food, 40% of them are from working families. You want to talk about the exploitation of children in America, the loss of childhood, the harming of American families? 33 million Americans continue to live in households that do not have an adequate supply of food. Food! 33 million Americans. And that's just in the United States. The second largest refugee problem in the United States is the responsibility of the United States. It's going on in Iraq right now. You have 2.5 million internal refugees, people who have been displaced. The vast majority of them families, the large majority of them children, and you have another 2 million who have fled the country altogether. This is today's New York Times. James Glantz and Alyssa Rubin writing, "Migration reshapes Iraq's sectarian landscape." Ethnic cleansing has been going on for 5 years, the Bush administration essentially sanctioning it. If they kill off enough people, if they move enough people around, then the violence will go down. Well, yeah, it will. But is that the way to do it, to bring it about? I don't think any reasonable person would say so. But some of the, less than moral people in the Republican Party think it's just a fine thing. In Baghdad alone, there are now nearly, this is from today's New York Times, there are nearly 170,000 families, accounting for almost 1 million people, who have fled their homes in search of security, shelter, water, electricity, functioning schools, or jobs to support their families. Many families have moved two or three or more times. The Red Crescent says all across Iraq, they're straining to provide aid just under their umbrella, just the Red Crescent, just this one group. They have 280,000 families. Now, including the children in these families, that's as many as 1 million people, just in that group. Although Iraqis of every income level, sect, ethnicity, and region in the country have been caught up in this migration, perhaps the most tragic consequences turn up where enormous numbers of poor Iraqi villagers have collected in camps, shanty towns, and urban slums after leaving behind almost everything they owned, said Dr. Saeed Haqqi, a physician who is president of the Red Crescent. It's tragic, absolutely tragic, he said. I've been a surgeon all my life. I've seen death many times. Never scared me, never shook me. But when I see the toll here in Iraq, that definitely shakes me. How could human beings let human beings suffer for so long? And we're worried about a TV show? What's going on, America?
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
She's over insured. Her favorite castaway is Thurston Howell III. She doesn't like big government, so it's no surprise I can be her lover long as I downsize. My conservative girlfriend got a tiny little heart full of passion. My conservative girlfriend, every Friday we go liberal bashing.
Yes.
The Supreme Court.
But wait, there's more! You know, we're talking about the exploitation of America's children, America's families, frankly. Almost 40 million people living in poverty in the United States. 10 million people in the United States literally at least one day a week not eating, not having enough food to eat. You want to talk? And we're talking, everybody in the media wants to talk about the exploitation of children in a TV show. Yeah, right. How about what's going on down in Louisiana? Jesse Jackson writing about it over in the Chicago Sun-Times, repost over at Common Dreams. They cut down the white tree at Jenna High School last month, about a year too late, he notes. On Thursday, a mass civil rights, that's tomorrow, mass civil rights march is going to take place in Jenna, Louisiana, demanding justice for the Jenna Six, the six young men. Speaking of children, the six young men unjustly charged with felonies, jailed with prohibitive bonds, and facing years in prison. Jenna, Louisiana, Klan country. Racial divides still run deep, notes Jesse Jackson. You know, a question in my mind, and I did some looking around, and I'm not able to find the answer to it. And I know we're on the air in Louisiana, and, you know, we have listeners from Louisiana. Maybe somebody would know, and you might want to just give us a shout and answer this question for me. I'm just curious, about the next step on this. And by the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com, I'm blogging about this on the front page of AirAmerica.com today, and our phone number 866-303-2270. But I'm curious if the economy in Jenna, Louisiana, might have been fairly strong 20 or 30 years ago, back before we saw this global free trade and the general insanity that's been going on all across the United States as the middle class has been wiped out and replaced by the working poor. Because very often, what you see is that racial tensions, certainly, I mean, the amazing study done that the BBC reported where they looked at 92 years of history in England, where every time conservatives took power in England, suicide rates went up among wage earners, by and large. Suicide rates went up, and whenever the liberals took power, suicide rates went down. You see the same thing, I would say you see the same thing with regard to racial tension. When people have a job, when they're busy, when they're working, they don't have time to sit around and hate. But when they don't have time, when their economic prospects are poor, when what they're looking at is a globalized world, a Thomas Friedman paradise world, where Americans are screwed, then, you know, these kind of things come out. And so I'm just curious, what, you know, is there a subtext to the Jenna story even that has to do with you know, 30 years of economy. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I would guess that there is, but I just don't know. But in any case, at Jenna High School, there was this tree where only, that was called the white tree. Only the white kids could sit there. Blacks and whites sat separately in the auditorium. This is Jesse Jackson's piece. Last year, at the beginning of the school, a freshman asked the principal if blacks could sit under the white tree. Principal said, sure, sit anywhere you want. The next day, three nooses in school colors were hung from the white tree. This is not a laughing matter in the South. As Jesse Jackson notes, this is a hate crime. Principal took it seriously. He expelled the white students responsible. But he was overruled by the school board and the superintendent. They said, this is just a prank. Then there was a sit-in. Then there were some fights. Then a white kid apparently taunting an African-American who had been beaten was thrown to the ground and kicked. He went to the hospital, released that night, attended the school's ring ceremony. And now the prosecutor, as Jesse Jackson writes, had six black teenagers arrested and charged with attempted murder. The first, Michael Bell, a 16-year-old sophomore star on the school football team, was tried as an adult for aggravated assault and conspiracy, both felonies, before a white judge and an all-white jury. He only a court-appointed counsel who called no witnesses on his behalf. The prosecutor argued that the gym shoes on his feet constituted a deadly weapon. He was convicted, jailed with a prohibitive bond, and is facing 20 years in prison. This is nuts. This is plain old, flat-out, flaming nuts. We are having a national debate over whether 40, probably by and large, middle or upper-middle-class kids are being exploited by having an opportunity to be TV stars, while we have 35.9 million people living in America in poverty, 12.9 million children. You've got some 5 to 6 to 7 million, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, children who literally do not have enough to eat. In this country, we've created the second largest refugee problem in the world. We've killed as many as a million Iraqis, civilians. And we've got another 4 million who are refugees, 2.5 million internal in the country. The vast majority of all these refugees, children. And the debate we're having in America in the context of what's exploitative of children is about a TV show? It's time for America to come back to our core values and wake up and talk about what's really going on and what's really important in this country. Take your calls next on this topic. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. Four.
But I guess we should have just expected them, right? Here we are. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. Strange days indeed. Everybody all hysterical about a stupid TV show. I don't know how stupid it is. Whatever. About a TV show. And nobody, as far as I can tell, if every time there is a news report or some special or some hysterical, bloviating, hysterical person on television or radio going, are these children being exploited on this TV show? Somebody should please call in and say, what about the estimated 3 million Iraqi children who are now displaced? What about the estimated 900,000 dead Iraqi children? What about the estimated 5 to 6 million American children who lack proper nutrition? What about the tens of millions of American children who are living in abject poverty? What about the children in Louisiana, in Jenna, Louisiana, who are the victims of blatant, overt racism? It's going to be a big march down there tomorrow, by the way. Jesse Jackson will be down there. It's let me commend it to you. Annie in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Welcome to the program, Annie. Thank you for calling. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Well, I was just calling. I listen quite a bit, and I was born and raised in New Orleans, and I now live in Baton Rouge. So I just wanted to let you know that, if only globalization were the problem, it probably would be a lot easier than what really is the problem. Mm-hmm. It's socially ingrained. If you look in, I think in Newsweek I was reading, they had a piece on the Jenna 6, and they were talking about how the barber at the barber shop has never cut a black person's hair because he wasn't sure how the rest of his customers would feel about it.
Oh my! So really, this is a city that is still living in 1930.
This is a state in most parts that is still living in the 1930s. There are remnants. It's from what I understand, it's fairly remnant of the oil bust around here, and it's fairly rural, it's fairly small, and it's, while become a little more racially diverse, it's very much minority black, so they're a very small minority, and it is still
so it's the bottom line is here is it, yeah, it's not economic, it's just plain old racist stuff. And thank you for enlightening me, Annie. I appreciate the call, and thank you. Stuart, Denver, Colorado. Hey, Stuart, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I have talked with a lot of people. You started your show off about Magna Carta.
Yeah.
And if you could explain that, because you do such a good job of explaining things like that, what the Magna Carta is and what it means about our rule of law in this country.
Yeah, here's just a thumbnail overview of it. Before 1215, the king basically owned the entire country in England and in most other kingdoms, and even the wealthy people, who the quote landowners, everything was subject to the king, and essentially they came to King John. The lords, as they were referred to as the time, in Runnymede, a place where actually there were very often battles, and they said to him, "We will let you. We now have our own armies, and we will let you continue to play king, but you're going to have to grant us some rights at law." And this was a major turning point in the history of kingdoms in Western civilization. And they had him sign this document called the Magna Carta. And here's Article 38 and 39 are the most significant ones. They establish what's called habeas corpus, which literally is Latin for produce the body. In other words, let this person go free if you can't charge him with something. And which is the basis of the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendment of our Constitution, by the way. And habeas corpus also appears twice in the Constitution itself. But Article 38 of the Magna Carta said, and I'm quoting from it, "In future, no official shall place a man on trial upon his own unsupported statement without producing credible witnesses to the truth of it." In other words, Article 38 said you got to have actual witnesses. You can't just charge somebody with something, all by yourself. You've got to have some truth. And Article 39 of the Magna Carta said, "No free man shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of his rights or possessions or outlawed or exiled or deprived of his standing in any other way. Nor will we proceed with force against him or send others to do so, except by the lawful judgment of his equals and the law of the land." In other words, you can only be charged with a crime if there has been a grand jury, if there's been an indictment, if there's been, if there's evidence of a crime, and ultimately there is a trial. And that was the basis of the Magna Carta. From 1215 to 1628, it just basically applied to the lords, to the wealthy folks. In 1628, as I recall, or no, 1627, King Charles I was the king, and he threw five knights in jail for not paying their taxes. And the knights were not the noblemen; they were viewed as kind of the high end of the average person. And this created a huge backlash in England, as so much that there were riots. And King Charles I had to back down, and in 1628, the Parliament, the British Parliament, passed the first civil rights law, the first actual Magna Carta law. King Charles said he had the right to throw these guys in jail per special mandantum domini regis, is what, in other words, because he had the right of a king. And ever since 1628, when that law was passed by the British, we no longer recognize that. And that is what the Republicans brought back last year when they did away with essentially the Magna Carta in the United States, when they did away with habeas corpus. And a terrible thing it is. Stuart, thanks for asking the question and giving me an opportunity to riff on one of my favorite topics. 1-866-303-2270. Keith in New Mexico. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, well, I'm one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs.
Good on you.
Yeah, and what you were talking about, the amount of hunger in the United States, one thing that the Coalition on Homelessness was saying, that there's over 700,000 homeless Americans, and at the same time, they say 45% of them are families with children, and we see this every day in feeding people, and yet at the same time, the you know, the governments like the city of Orlando is now taking one of our members to trial for serving free food in a public park.
Oh, my God, how dare he? And at the same time, I guarantee you all the talking heads on TV are going to be today going to be talking about, are we exploiting these 40 middle-class kids by putting them on TV? And they're not going to be talking about the issues that you just raised, Keith.
Yeah, and this poor young man, he's only like 18, and he's facing like 6 months in jail for feeding the poor. Because he fed 26 people instead of 25. And
what, he had a permit for 25? Was that the deal?
Well, now if you have a picnic, you know, they had an undercover cop actually count the person standing out each ladle of stew. And when he got to the 26th person, they said, aha, that's like, serving too many people. And there's,
you've committed a crime. You've committed a crime. You've fed hungry people in America.
That's mind-boggling. And I spent 2 years in jail for feeding hungry people in San Francisco until finally the Amnesty International and the UN and other organizations came to our aid and they got the city to stop bothering us. But, and the only place we get arrested is in the United States. We are all over the world. We have no problems really in any other countries. It's just only in the United States.
And you're not going to be hearing about it in the mainstream media in America. Keith, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Alan in Texas. Hey, Alan.
Yeah, how you doing? I'm a 50-year-old white male from Texas, and I'm calling about the Louisiana situation.
Mm-hmm.
I have a granddaughter who's half black, and I love her to death. But I tell you, if this was six white boys whipping on a black boy, all we'd hear from y'all would be, "Oh, they want to kill him because he's black." I do not understand how y'all think. Regardless of who it is, it's wrong. But if it's a white beating a black, it's a hate crime. If it's a black beating a white, well, he just happened to beat him. That's
no, I think, Alan, you don't understand what happened here. The white kids beat up the black kids. They got suspended from school, and then the suspension was lifted. One of the black kids beat up one of the white kids, and he's now facing 20 years in prison for attempted murder.
One other thing I'd like to say. I watched Oprah one day, and she put some black guy on the street, and all the white people ignored him, didn't look at him. And I thought, why don't she put a white guy in the middle of Harlem at night and see if they don't kill him instead of not look at him?
Yeah, well, having walked through Harlem at night, I'll tell you, in all probability, that he wouldn't be killed, the fact of the matter. But nonetheless, Alan, the point that you're raising, I think, is actually an important one. And without getting into jingoism, and that is that there is in all of us, no matter how much we may want to deny it, there is in all of us a kernel of the, if not the reality of racism, the potential for racism, because it's an absolutely human instinct to say, these are mine. This is my family. These are my children. This is my family. This is my community. Those people over there, they're different. They're other. And race is a real easy other because it's a real visible one. And where it becomes toxic is when we start saying, instead of, oh, that's just other, we say that's other and that's inferior, or that's other and we have to destroy them. That's when it becomes really, really toxic. And that, in my opinion, is what's going on in Jenna.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American males. Soul-saving, flag-waving, brush-loving, land-paving, personal friends to the quail. Quite diligently, working so hard to keep the free reins of this democracy. From tree-hugging, peace-loving, pot-smoking, barefooting, folks singing hippies like me.
Here we are, my friends. No, really, we are. We are the mainstream of America. 9 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270. Charles in Kansas. You're on the air, Charles. What's up?
Oh, how are you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Charles. Thank you.
I always like listening to that part of it. I wanted to let you know that I don't hear any complaints either when they talk about the Chinese who export 10 to 20% of their products using slave labor. That's according to Amnesty International.
Or the slave labor that was used to build the U.S. embassy in Iraq?
Yes. And also child labor that's done in all the other little, what they call the little miniature dragons of the East Asia area there, including Vietnam now, Indonesia. They use child labor there 12 to 13, 14, 16 hours a day.
Saipan, where Tom DeLay goes over and says, this is a cauldron of democracy, isn't it wonderful? And they lock the women up, many of them 15, 16, 17 years old, lock them up in basically like prison enclosures to work, and so that they can say made in America because it's a U.S. territory?
That's right. That's exactly it. Of course, the other thing is the reason that part of the reason we have the problems that we have, that they're complaining all about this child labor and stuff like this with this program is of course you're dealing with using the Republican wedge, the culture wars.
Yeah.
Where they don't like what Hollywood does with this, that, or the other, and all the quote liberal activities and hedonist activities that are going on and taking.
Yeah. How dare Les Moonves do something like this? How dare a television executive, exploit 40 children? It's fine if the Bush administration kills a million children, but Les Moonves, we can't have that. Charles, good point. Thank you very much. David in Louisiana. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. I just wanted to respond to the Gina 6. Because I live about 30 miles away from Gina. We play them football and baseball and stuff. Back
it's pronounced Gina, not Jenna. It's pronounced Gina?
Yeah, Gina. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
And I was just wondering, because I never heard anything about the white kids beating up the black kid. I heard the white kids put up a noose or something, or one white kid did. He put up a noose in a tree or something.
Right.
And that set it off or whatever.
You know, now that I'm looking back on the news story here, I think you're right. The kids who were expelled were not expelled for beating up the black kids. They were expelled for putting up the noose. But that's essentially, I would argue that that's not all that different. A hate crime, and I think Jesse Jackson is right in calling this a hate crime, is when you are attempting not just to intimidate an individual, but to intimidate an entire class of people. I would argue that hanging those nooses was even a worse crime than getting into a fist fight with somebody.
Yeah, well, I grew up in California, and I was born in Thousand Oaks area, and I was raised in up there in Mendocino County area until I was like 15. Then I moved down to Louisiana, and been there ever since. You know, about 16 years, and it's two different cultures. It's kind of like a rude awakening for me. You know, because you see, it's like, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but. The people are just different.
No, I understand exactly what you're talking about, David. I mean, I've been down there. My son-in-law's parents live near New Orleans and have for years and years. James Lee Burke is my favorite author. He writes constantly about New Iberia. You get a sense of the place. And Ellen Ratner has told us some amazing stories about the work that they're doing down there. Jim in Berkeley, California. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, so many outrages, so little time. It's hard to know where to start.
Yeah, only 3 hours a day here.
I wanted to thank you for opening your show the way you did today, talking about habeas corpus and about the Republican filibusters that aren't. And the spineless Democrats were letting him get away with it. In that light, I wanted to tell you about a phone call I had several weeks ago with Senator Dianne Feinstein's office. She's, of course, one of my two senators. And I called on the filibuster issue. Of course, the habeas corpus issue wasn't at that point front and center. But my question was, why are the Democrats allowing the Republicans basically to filibuster for free? Why not make them actually filibuster in the way you described it at the opening of the show? And I spoke with a staffer, and the staffer said, well, you know, that's just not how it's done anymore. It hasn't been done that way for decades. And you poor little citizen, you really don't know what you're talking about. And this went back and forth for a while, and I tried to persuade them that there was, you know, nothing in the Senate rules that forbade the old-style filibuster from coming back.
Well, not only that, when the Democrats were talking about filibustering Sam Alito, the Republicans were saying, okay, we're going to make you do it.
Sure.
That's why they came up with a gang of 14 as a compromise.
Yep. Anyway, after, you know, maybe 5 to 7 minutes of this, the Feinstein staffer just hung up on me. He said, have a great day, hung up the phone. And that was the end of that. So that's the attitude of our senators right now, at least some of them, towards
that's the attitude of that one staffer. But, broadly, yes, the Democrats are saying we're going to give the Republicans a pass, and I think it's a shame. And for our listeners who don't understand this, you know, filibuster is a fancy word that a lot of people don't really get, and there's, you know, no bad in that. The way the Senate works, the House of Representatives doesn't work this way. In the House of Representatives, if you can get a majority vote, one more than half of all the votes, if you can get 51%, 50% plus one vote, the bill passes. In the Senate, if you get 50% of the vote plus, you know, one, if you get a majority vote, a bill will pass. However, 40 senators, a minority of senators, because there's 100 senators, 40 senators can say no. We're not going to allow there to be a vote. That's called a filibuster. And basically what they do is they have a discussion about, they just keep the conversation going. And it used to be that they forced these guys to keep talking, and so they'd have to talk for days after days after days. Now they just say, okay, you're going to do it, we'll just cut you a pass.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
But it doesn't cause mental stiffness, merely excitation. Welcome back to the program. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman with you. The second hour of our program. And we get emails. Some of them a little strange. This one's from Rick in Phoenix. It's actually a physical letter. He's responding to the op-ed I wrote for Common Dreams last week, and it got spread all over the internet, and we emailed it out to our listener group. You can subscribe, by the way, to our email list over at tomhartman.com. And he says, I told my friend Bob I'd send you a note. And goes on to talk about how well informed he is about the Middle East and essentially how wrong I am. He says, you have a very long ways to go before to even begin to find reality here. I would trust President Bush with my life, and I wouldn't trust the Democrats as far as I could throw them. We are living in a very dangerous world and dangerous times. Now, Rick, I understand your terror, Rick. And I understand you probably sleep underneath your bed, and you probably lock your bedroom door, and probably as a kid you had monsters in the closet. I understand. But, you know, get a grip, would you? He goes on, Iran has been building for war for well over 15 years now. China, Russia, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas are all also building for war. President Bush is by far your best friend and is keeping you breathing right now. Oh, yeah. It is much better to pay for war with our dollars instead of our lives. Oh, really? So we should, what, let other people die? I mean, but we may be paying for war with both in the near future, he writes. We have well over 900 mosques preaching hatred toward the West in our country right now. Do you get this now? It's all about the Muslims. It's the other. Remember when we were talking about Gina in the last hour, I mentioned this notion of the other. Rick in Phoenix goes on to say, as much as you would like to think, President Bush is not why the Muslims hate us. Hate is in the Quran, and stupid hate is in the heart of liberals. I would stop writing and start learning if I were you, he writes Rick. He says, truth is not what you want it to be. Truth is what God says it is, and you are nowhere near it. The same can be said of the Muslims. They are nowhere near truth. Muslims preach war. God promotes life. Signed, Rick. I'm not going to toss out his last name here in Phoenix. Well, Rick, let me share with you some similar thinking. This was written some time back. And just two words have been changed. Now, I will share with you, when I finish reading this, who wrote it and what the words were. Actually, I think maybe it'll have more impact if I just tell you right up front. This is from Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. And Joe McPherson used to be a producer of this program. Zen Pickle, his name on the blogs, went through Mein Kampf and replaced the word Jew with the word liberals and the word Germany with the word America. And that's it. Those are the only changes. It must be admitted that all this was partly the result of extraordinarily crafty tactics on the part of liberals on the one hand and obviously stupid official naivete on the other hand. The liberals were too clever to allow a simultaneous attack to be made on the whole of their press. No one section functioned as cover for the other. The national papers, also in liberal hands, knew how to camouflage themselves as model examples of objectivity. They studiously avoided harsh language, knowing well that blockheads are capable of judging only by external appearances and never able to penetrate to the real depth and meaning of anything. This form of human frailty was carefully studied and understood by the liberal press. Certainly in days to come, the liberals will raise a tremendous cry through their newspapers once a hand is laid on their favorite nest, once a move is made to put an end to this scandalous liberal press, and once this instrument which shapes public opinion is brought under conservative control and no longer in the hands of liberals and enemies of the people. I am certain that this will be easier for us than it was for our fathers. The scream of the 12-inch shrapnel is more penetrating than the hiss of 1,000 liberal newspaper vipers. Therefore, let them go on with their hissing. By means of the liberal press, the liberals spread the colossal falsehood about American militarism throughout the world, and they try to inculpate America by every possible means. While at the same time, the Democratic Party refuses to assent to the measures that are necessary for the adequate training of our national defense forces. What soon gave me cause for very serious consideration were the activities of the liberals in certain branches of life, into the mystery of which I penetrated little by little. Was there any shady undertaking, any form of foulness, especially in cultural life, in which at least one liberal did not participate? On putting the probing knife carefully to that kind of abscess, one immediately discovered, like a maggot in a putrescent body, a little liberal who was often blinded by the sudden light. In my eyes, the charge against liberalism became a grave one the moment I discovered the liberal activities in the press, in arts, in literature, in the theater, all unctuous protests were now more or less futile. Here is a pestilence, a moral pestilence, with which the public is being infected. I am happy at last to know for certain that a liberal is not an American. Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. Or we could go back to Rick's letter from Phoenix. President Bush is by far your best friend, keeping you breathing right now. As much as you would like to think, President Bush is not why the Muslims hate us. Hate is in the Quran, and hate, stupid hate, is in the hearts of liberals. Yeah. See, this is what, you know, Milton Mayer was writing about in his book, They Thought They Were Free, the American journalist who went over to Germany after World War II and talked to good Nazis, good Germans, actually, and people who they were not enthusiastic Nazis. They were people, many of them actually hadn't even joined the party. Those who did so because they needed to do so to keep their jobs. He got to know 10 of them very well. He spent about a year there. He wrote the stories of 10 average Germans, Christian Germans, Nazis, who were not like part of the killing machine. They just a college professor, a guy, a baker, a guy who had a bakery. I mean, things like that. A brick maker in a little town. And one of them, the college professor, he said, what happened here was the gradual habituation of the people, little by little, to being governed by surprise, to receiving decisions deliberated in secret, to believing that the situation was so complicated that the government had to act on information which the people could not understand. Or the situation was so dangerous that even if the people could understand it, it couldn't be released because of national security. Back to Rick's letter from Phoenix. Tom, we are living in a very dangerous world and dangerous times. Iran has been building for war for well over 15 years now. China, Russia, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas are also building for war. Are we hearing echoes? The college professor that Mayer interviewed in Germany in 1948, 1949, this separation of government from people, this widening of the gap, took place so gradually and so insensibly, each step disguised, perhaps not even intentionally, as a temporary emergency measure or associated with true patriotic allegiance or with real social purposes, and all the crises and reforms, real reforms too, so occupied the people that they did not see the slow motion underneath of the whole process of government growing remoter and remoter. To live in this process is absolutely not to be able to notice it. Please try to believe me, unless one has a much greater degree of political awareness, acuity, than most of us ever had occasion to develop. Each step was so small, so inconsequential, so well explained, or on occasion regretted, that unless one were detached from the whole process from the beginning, unless one understood that the whole thing, what the whole thing was in principle, what all these little measures are that no patriotic German could resent, must someday lead to, one no more saw it developing from day to day than a farmer in his field sees the corn growing. And then one day, it's over his head. Habeas corpus. The Senate, there were enough votes to give us back habeas corpus. But the Republicans and 100% of the votes, I have the vote in front of me, the Republicans would not allow the discussion to end so a vote could be held. This is called a filibuster, maintaining the discussion. And Joe Lieberman, the one independent, all the other votes were Republicans. Now, there were some Republicans who voted with the Democrats, and God bless them. Let's acknowledge them. Sununu, Specter, Snow, Smith, Bernie Sanders, the independent, obviously voted with the Democrats on this thing. And let's see, are there any other Republicans on this list? And Hagel and Lugar. That's it. Those are the Republicans who voted for traditional American values. God bless them. We need more people who are willing to stand up and say, we are not going to be terrified, thank you very much. We believe in America.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Blood in the name of liberty. All right.
Taking Back America. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room and or participate in our message boards. AirAmerica.com, if you want to see my blog post today and participate in it, either on the main page, Nancy Scola's blog there, or also on the Tom Hartman page. There's another blog there as well. So, just very quickly in the news, Senator Webb, Jim Webb, had introduced legislation, which the Republicans have successfully filibustered, that suggests that troops should have reasonable rotations, which basically means that unless Bush has a draft, he's not going to be able to maintain his troop levels beyond the spring. So now John Warner and John McCain, both Republicans, are apparently offering what they call a sensible, it's a sense of the Senate resolution, a sensible response to this. And this was apparently discussed, according to The Hill, at a closed-door luncheon meeting yesterday by the Republicans. They're trying to prevent defections. This is very strange. It's very interesting to watch the Republicans, who are on the one hand terrified of the organized crime institution that has become the Republican Party, and on the other hand, you know, the few Republicans who actually believe in the values of America, the traditional values of this country. It's a good thing to see. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I listened so long, I changed topics a little bit. On the issue of morality, you're saying, why do we get so highly charged about some issues and not others? Well, first off, the Republicans have redefined morality. For it to be a moral issue, it must be divisive and highly emotionally charged to the average person. But most important, it must be revenue neutral. That's very important. They've taken the position that the government has the authority to subjugate personal rights to the collective will. Now, whenever we talk about health, education, or general welfare issues, morality has now been redefined as a personal responsibility versus a social responsibility. Now, that's just my cut.
Sure.
As an observer.
No, I think you're right. And that's the traditional difference between conservative and liberal morality perspectives, is that conservatives traditionally want to know what you're doing in private. They're concerned about private morality. What are you doing in your bedroom? What are you smoking in your living room? And liberals are concerned about what are we all doing out in public? Are there hungry among us? Are there homeless among us? Are there people in prison inappropriately? Basically the morality that is outlined in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament, you know, in Matthew 25, Jesus laying this out, and as well as in the Sermon on the Mount. That's traditional liberal morality, and there's a very real difference between the two. And then you add in the fact that you've got, now we have a prison industrial complex in the United States. We've privatized so many of our prisons that you actually have prison corporations lobbying for a longer sentencing, for three strikes and you're out laws, for heavier penalties and for less violent crimes, please don't ever end that war against drugs, because, you know, that's a million people in our prisons that we can make 30, 40, 50,000 bucks a year per person off of. It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts.
Yeah, I basically synopsized it as we've socialized personal rights and we've personalized social responsibility.
Yeah, well said, Bill. Well said. Thank you very much. Ted in Castro Valley, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Hey, thank you, Tom. Actually, I called yesterday for the same reason, and actually today you answered one of my two questions on the filibuster and the 40 votes. Mm-hmm. Now I understand that. And by the way, I've been listening to you since you took, what's the name's place?
Al Franken.
Yeah. You got a great show.
Thank you. And Al's a good guy, and his Senate campaign, alfranken.org, can use help as well. So, you know, check that out.
And my original hero, Bernie Ward from San Francisco, once said a couple weeks ago that I forgot how he said it, but he said you're even better than him.
Oh, Bernie's great. I've been on his show before, but nonetheless, Todd, we've got to take a break here in about 30 seconds.
Okay. Oh no. I wanted you to explain maybe after the break how this thing about I heard about how Obie and Pelosi doesn't really have to let this appropriation out of the committee in the first place. You know, I was wondering about the filibuster part and why don't they do these things? What's the big? Why is that so scary for them? when the
right.
damn Republicans.
Let me take a shot at that when we come back from the break, Ted. It's a good question. You know, how do things get out of committee in the House of Representatives? How is that different from a filibuster in the Senate? And why is it that the Democrats are not standing up and speaking out and pounding the table? Or are they, and it's just not being covered in the media? 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Just to make it through. When all you gotta keep is strong. Move along like I know you do. And even when your hope is gone, move along just to make it through.
34 minutes past the hour. Auto shadophobia. Is it in remission? Autoshadophobia, a term that David Sirota coined a few months ago. It's fancy word for fear of your own shadow. The Democrats have autoshadophobia. They're afraid of their own shadow. But he sees it going away. Now, in the House of Representatives, the way that you can block a piece of legislation from coming to the floor for a vote is by simply not letting it out of committee. It is possible to get around that if you can get a majority of members of the House of Representatives to co-sponsor it. Even then, there are some parliamentary tricks that can be played, certainly that have been played. And probably Bernie Sanders can do a better job of educating everybody on the arcane details of this than can I. I've not been involved in the process. But bottom line is that bills in the House typically come out of a committee. They go through the committee process. They get marked up, and the committee then votes on them. And if the majority of the committee says yes, then it goes to the floor of the House. And if a majority of the members of the House of Representatives vote yes on it, then it goes to the Senate. Or a bill coming from the Senate can go to the House in the same process. In the Senate, you have 100 senators. And in the Senate, in theory, it takes 50 votes, as I mentioned before, to pass, or 51 votes, to pass a piece of legislation, a simple majority. However, as few as 40 senators can prevent, it takes 60 votes to what's called vote for cloture, and it's to vote to end the debate on a topic. And so as long as a topic is being debated, it can't be voted on. So as long as 40 senators say, no, we want to keep talking, they can keep talking till the cows come home, and that vote just never happens. And it used to be that, you know, these filibusters would last for days in some cases. In the last couple of decades, they've all gotten very polite about it, and somebody will simply say, I declare a filibuster, and everybody says, okay, that's fine. We don't have 60 votes to break the filibuster, so we're just going to move on. And there are a lot of us who think that the Democrats should go back to pushing for okay, you want a filibuster, you're going to have to start talking and keep talking and tie up the Senate. And nothing's going to get done because the Republicans are going to stand there and they're going to tell us why we shouldn't have habeas corpus, for example, or why we shouldn't have the Posse Comitatus law that says it's against the law for the president to use military forces against Americans and so on. So anyhow, just very quickly, David Sirota writing, he's quoting a story off the wire services, the AP. After weeks of suggesting Democrats would temper their approach to Iraq legislation in a bid to attract more Republicans, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid declared abruptly yesterday that he had no plans to do so. Democratic leader said he will call for a vote this month on several anti-war proposals, including one by Senator Carl Levin, that will insist President Bush end U.S. combat next summer. The proposals would be mandatory and not leave Bush wiggle room, said Reid, the Democrat from Nevada. There are no goals. It's all definite timelines, he told reporters of the planned legislation. If that's the case, and if Harry Reid does this, God bless you, Harry Reid. And this is where I would suggest, if you are calling your members of the Senate, particularly Democratic members of the Senate, We don't want goal. You don't want a piece of legislation. Wouldn't it be nice if we got out of Iraq by? No, we want specific timelines. We want this thing to come to an end. Stop the slaughter. 1-866-303-2270, our number. John in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for a great program. I was influenced to call on the Genesis 6 because I'm rereading Barry's Rising Tide. And it turns out that Greenville, Mississippi, where that book is centered, happens to be 150 miles from Jenna. And Jenna is also close enough to the Mississippi. It's around 50 miles. And what goes unnoticed in these discussions, if you look back at the history of what might be happening in Jenna, is that the emergence of the Ku Klux Klan, especially in that area, had as much to do with property as with race. And by that I mean that the planters in that Delta area controlled much of the land. And so not only was there enormous friction between the planters and the poor whites, but the blacks were seen as competitors in terms of labor. And my point being that this Jenna problem is far more complex. If you look at it strictly as a racial issue, which it is okay, but it's far more complex and there's just a lot more history in terms of territory and ownership than meets the eye. And that brings me to my central point, because if you look at Iraq or if you look at racial issues in the United States, you very often look at a case where the minority or the smaller group is pictured as a threat. And this is very, very true in Jenna, and it seems to me to be true in this Iran thing that's coming up and in this Muslim thing that the group...
Yeah, and it's an old song. I mean, and this is when I was reading from Mein Kampf and also from this letter from this to me from this guy, Rick
and Fields. And by the way, I read the book that you mentioned about Germany, the afterwar. But I wanted to reinforce what you were saying, that the minority or the weaker group is often built up to be a threat, which it is not, and then attacked. And I see that in Jenna. Not possibly, I don't know all the facts down there, but I certainly see it in world events. Yeah. And I want to thank you for your program.
You're welcome. Thank you, John, and thank you for your kind comments. Yeah, it's called scapegoating and depersonalizing. In order to have a war against a people, you must first convince the warriors and the people who are supporting the warriors that those people are not people. You have to depersonalize them. Bob in Denver, Colorado. Hey, and you use names and things like that. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, Tom, I have some comments or insight. You mentioned earlier about how the German government got separated from the population, and the people kind of more or less had the attitude that the government would take care of everything. They weren't involved anymore.
Yeah, I was sharing from Milton Mayer's book, They Thought They Were Free, which was one of our books of the month over at BuzzFlash.com. It's been print since the 50s.
I'm a first-generation American. My parents immigrated here from Germany after the First World War. Mm-hmm. And the First World War was like the watershed in their life. If you're familiar with All Quiet on the Western Front, that was a story of my father. My mother ended up in a war zone toward the end of the war. But my point I want to make is that people become susceptible to this manipulation from trauma. And the First World War was traumatic for a lot of countries, but like England, France, and Germany, I mean, they lost millions of their young men.
Sure.
But in Germany, to top it off, the civilian population was on a starvation diet during the war.
And after the war, the Treaty of Versailles was absolutely they handled it totally wrong, because the Treaty of Versailles basically said that after World War One, that Germany was going to have to pay war reparations to all these other countries for the damage that they had done in World War One, and they'd have to pay them in Deutschmarks. And so what the German government did, it was such a huge tax, essentially, that it wiped out Germany. And so what the German government did was they inflated their currency to reduce the value. So, we owe you a billion Deutschmarks, no problem. Here's a billion Deutschmarks, but a billion Deutschmarks now will buy a loaf of bread, And this hyperinflation that came about in Germany as a consequence of the German government's attempt to deal with the Treaty of Versailles. And I realize I'm hyper-simplifying this for any history majors. My apologies. But in large part led directly to the German people to the horrible economic meltdown that led the German people to say, you know, strong man Hitler, he says he's going to save our nation. We're ready to listen.
Yeah. My point is the whole population was traumatized by the war and the events after. And to bring it up to the current times, we were traumatized at 9/11, and Bush keeps working this, trying to, you know, as wartime traumas go, 9/11 was pretty much on a small scale compared to what all the other countries went to World War II, but they had... His idea, keep repeating it, is to keep us in fear so they'll take care of everything.
Yep, absolutely right, Bob, and very well said. Thank you very much. And that's the thing. People who are afraid are not thinking rationally. Joe in Long Island, and that's what Bush wants. That's what the Republicans want. Joe in Long Island, and Joe Lieberman. Joe in Long Island, New York, no relation to Joe Lieberman, I'm assuming.
What's up, Joe? Please, no. Tom, just curiosity. Tom first had us going nuts. Had the Democrats going nuts about the nuclear option when we mentioned the word, that we might.
The nuclear option was doing away with the filibuster, because the filibuster is just a rule. It's not part of the Constitution. It's just a rule that the Senate operates by.
Right.
And so he said, what we're going to do is the nuclear option is we'll just blow up the Senate rule that says that 40 senators can keep conversation going.
Well, why doesn't the Democrats use that nuclear option?
Probably for the same reason that the Republicans ultimately didn't, and that is that both Democrats and Republicans think that it's a good thing that the filibuster be there, that there needs to be a counterweight, a flywheel to quick action. The Senate is the most deliberative of the bodies. It's the most cautious. And I think that there's a broad consensus that that's a good thing. Now, on the other hand, the Republicans, while frankly, I don't think that they ever actually intended to use the nuclear option, they very, very successfully used the threat of the use of the nuclear option. And the Democrats might want to learn from that, although I don't know if it would be taken seriously. I think they just need to stand by and say, you know, you're going to have a filibuster, you're going to have the filibuster. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
TomHartman.com, however you spell it, will get you there. AirAmerica.com, our blog on the homepage, as well as our blog on the Tom Hartman page. A lot going on today. Stephanie in San Francisco, California, listening on KKGN. Hey, Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I'm calling about something I know you can relate to, having lived in Germany. I grew up in Germany until I was 14, and then I came to the United States. And one of the things that's always been interesting for me is to watch, you know, I consider myself really a citizen of both countries. Actually, I am. But what's interesting is when I grew up in Germany and my grandparents, who were, of course, there during the war, and I lived in Munich, and we would go driving past Dachau, and we would go and visit there. And my grandparents would tell me the stories after World War II and also what had happened. They always told me that it could happen again anywhere. It wasn't just in Germany. And here in the U.S., you start to talk about that, and people go, oh, but this is America, and it can never happen here. And I see the things happening, and I'm just shaking my head. And it's incredible to me, the lessons that my grandparents told me to always remember and to ask questions, and then here people don't see it. They don't even remember news stories from 2 years ago that this administration has done. And it's very upsetting because I've always been told to question things, and I'm trying, and then I see what's going on. And you had your previous caller talking about the filibuster, and one thing I wondered about is, you know, if they can change the rule, can't they change it back?
Yeah, they can. They can.
Well, but then why don't they do that? I feel as if the Democrats don't realize that they're literally the last chance, at least as far as I'm concerned, to fight for our Constitution and our democracy. And this is a street fight. This isn't a boxing match anymore with rules, really. And they are not fighting. I mean, the habeas corpus filibuster today, I mean, has me spitting venom. I mean, I cannot believe it, that people aren't just in shock. And
well, I think a lot of people are in shock, Stephanie, but tragically, so many Americans are not following this. They're following, you know, what's on TV tonight, or you know, what's on sports and whatnot. But I'm right there with you. I have, in fact, when we lived in Germany, we took our children to Dachau, and it's obviously not the worst. I mean, the camps that were built inside Germany were not death camps. They were work camps. They put the death camps outside Germany so that Hitler could claim that, I didn't do that. The Poles did that, you know, or the Dutch did that, you know, at Belsen. But it still was a horrible place, and many people were murdered there, of course.
And my grandparents always said that, you know, things were getting bad, and people saw it, but then what would it take to make it bad enough until they saw it? And I keep wondering that about Americans. What is it going to take for them to see? And you were also talking about hyperinflation before. They told me all about that. They told me to always have money outside of the country, and we do. We have currency and accounts in two different countries, we own property in other countries, and they always said, be careful. And, you know, meanwhile, Wall Street and the news are talking about how great this Fed, you know, cut is, and then look at what's happening to the dollar, and look what's happening to oil and gold. And are any Americans paying attention?
Yeah, gold this morning shot through 720, something like that. Oil is over 82. And all these are indications that the dollar is collapsing, and that's exactly what happened to the German mark before, you know, in the time that led up to World War II. Now, Stephanie, your analysis is spot on, and it is, you know, it's not something I'm going to stop talking about. And I hope my colleagues in talk radio, both on the left and the right, frankly, because there are some good people right across the board who are concerned about the future of this country. We may have differences about, you know, how we should have Social Security organized or something like that. But this is fundamental core stuff, habeas corpus, fundamental core stuff.
Well, Tom, thank you. I really appreciate everything you're doing. And I'm so glad that we have you on the radio. So
thank you, Stephanie.
Keep talking.
I'll do it. And thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you, and I appreciate it. Harlan in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Harlan, thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, first of all, thanks for your show. I really appreciate your efforts there and the fight you're putting on. Second, I want to respond to Rick's letter from Arizona saying that my experience with God is that God's a God of love, not a God of war or hate. And the main reason I'm calling is about the nukes that were transported under a B-52, and that somebody in the Air Force had enough guts to blow the whistle on this, and all we heard is there's going to be some kind of investigation, and nothing else has been said. It's kind of
Deafening silence, deafening, which is leading to all kinds of conspiracy theories floating around the internet, and now we've got dueling conspiracy theories, and which doesn't mean that they're not wrong. There's a lot of questions out there, Harlan, and hopefully we will have some answers soon. Len in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Len, what's up?
Oh, not a heck of a lot today, other than gold, as you were saying. But, you know, I was listening to you talking about the death and destruction in New Orleans and in Iraq. And, you know, I think, you know, Bush has, you know, in his mind, the opinion that given we're arming both sides over there and giving them enough time that the population will dwindle down between the people who kill each other and move out, that they can just control it better.
Yeah, it's already happened. It's already happened. Ethnic cleansing, the over 80% of the ethnic cleansing of that nation has already happened. You have
huge areas. Yeah, they can't control it yet.
Baghdad used to be Baghdad used to be a very, very mixed community, and it's no longer a, I'm sorry, Len, your phone is going off. It's no longer a mixed community. What you have is the Shia areas where if Sunnis go in, they will be murdered. You have Sunni areas where if Shia go in, they'll be murdered. And ultimately, it's bringing some stability, but it's bringing that stability at the cost of 4.5 million refugees, 1 million dead civilians, not to mention nearly 4,000 dead U.S. servicemen and some 40,000 to 60,000 injured U.S. servicemen and women, not to mention the probably 100,000 or more who are going to come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, not to mention an area contaminated with depleted uranium, not to mention the incredible damage that has been inflicted on the reputation of the United States of America all across the world. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Is science dead or dying in the United States? My son teaches science at a university down in Georgia, or the University of Georgia. And has often bemoaned the state of science and science education of incoming kids. It's a serious issue and a serious question, and something that maybe we don't know everything we think we know about.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
That thinks that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is it, as the Firesign Theater would say, is it wrong? Executive editor of Discover Magazine, Corey Powell, is with us. DiscoverMagazine.com, their website, and, of course, the magazine on newsstands all over America. And, Corey, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
You guys took on this issue in exploring the state of science in a recent issue of Discover, and I'm curious, what's your take on the state of science in America? Is science dying, and is it a uniquely an American problem? If so,
well, you know, one of the centerpiece articles in this issue is called "Science Under Siege," which I think that's probably a fair assessment of you know, the state of science in the United States right now. In the post-war world, the United States was not only the world's largest economy, it was also the world's largest, you know, science machine. More research, more Nobel Prizes, more funding. In every way, the United States was the preeminent place. So you see two big trends happening. One is just, with globalization, with China and sort of other economies catching up, America's unique position is kind of the leader of science is dwindling, and some of that I think is inevitable, and not necessarily such a bad thing. What I do find concerning is that we're making a lot of bad decisions that are making it hard even just to keep up, even just to sort of keep our place in the global economy and in what I would call the intellectual economy. That we're not really. We've gotten so used to having, automatic leadership that we're not really doing the things that we need to do to protect education, to protect funding, and to protect...
Corey, in France, if a kid graduates from high school with, any kind of reasonable grades at all and wants to go to college, all the way to the PhD level, all the way to the MD level, all the way to the highest levels possible, they can do it for free. And increasingly, and to a large extent, this is also true in Taiwan. It's in many cases true in China. It's to a large extent true in Japan. What we're finding is that many of the countries of the world that are now starting to pick up a lot of those patents and Nobel Prizes and turning out some of the greatest scientists are doing so in part because there's not, as we have in the United States, basically a litmus test or a lens that you must pass. I'm lacking a good metaphor here. A bar, that you must pass through that has to do with how much money your parents have or how many assets they have that you can borrow against in order to get a student loan.
Yeah, I mean this idea, it seems it's one of the most obvious things in the world, which is you have you know, you have a you have national standards of what everybody should know, of what you consider the basics of what an educated literate person knows. And in this country, the idea of national education standards are considered almost like a form of socialism, that that you're taking control away from the parents and from the local school boards, which to me seems a bit crazy.
Yeah, but what I'm these are really two different issues. Then I'm saying that I believe that one of the things that made America such a leader in science in the world, particularly in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, is that the generation that fought World War II, over 1 million men came back and enrolled in college. My father was one of them on the GI Bill. They went to college for free. Not only did he go to college for free, he got a stipend to pay for his rent and for his books. I mean, they actually made it possible to go to college, and millions of people did. And that now has gone. And so and then also my generation, I'm in my 50s, when I was going to college during that period of time, you could, and I did, work your way through college. I didn't finish, but you could work your way through college. But my wife did. You work your way through college. She put herself through college working as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's. I was doing radio as basically a minimum wage job. You could afford to pay for college and live on that back, 30 years ago. You can't anymore. What we have seen, just an incredibly massive war, not just on science at the primary level that you're talking about, and I know that Discover Magazine is talking about, but also at an economic level of higher education. I'm very concerned about this.
Right. I mean, there's a huge question of priorities here. Every year, the president rolls out a budget proposal, and the numbers are enormous, and it feels like there's sort of lots of little nitpicky debates about where the money is going. But if you look at the big picture, the amount of money that we spend to support science education, as you say, to allow people, sort of a high-quality, free education, the amount of money that we spend on that is declining. If you look at the amount of money, how much research in this country is supported by the government versus private industry, the balance is radically shifted away from the government toward private industry. And there's a wholesale abdication of science on the part of the government. And it's a very real change of priorities, which is happening sort of in slow motion, and people, almost don't notice it because of the little day-to-day debates.
Well, there have also been some significant shifts. Before Ronald Reagan became president, the National Science Foundation funded most research that produced new drugs in the United States. Today, the National Science Foundation funds most research that produces new drugs in the United States. However, before Reagan, if the NSF had funded the research and a drug company, a pharmaceutical company, had participated and co-funded it, then the patent was owned by both, and the royalties, in part, came back to the federal government. Post-Reagan, the royalties all go to the drug companies. So we, the taxpayers, are now paying for the research, and we're getting nothing back in exchange for it. I mean, this is just, one of many of these massive shifts in priorities that have favored wealthy corporations and that have, in my opinion, harmed science.
Oh, I'll tell you, I actually think there's some question there of whether sending some of the profits back to private industry, whether that has a positive effect on innovation. I mean, to me, the more distressing thing is it's not just what happens to those patents, but what happens to oversight. The government has essentially outsourced the whole process of if you want to the EPA outsources studies on pollution to the polluters, essentially. The FDA outsources studies on drug safety to the pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, DuPont and British Petroleum there are four seats on the Science Foundation. I forget the name of it. I was reading this on the International Herald Tribune on the train across Germany on Sunday. There are four seats on the federal organization that's responsible for examining the situation of climate change in the United States and around the world. One of those seats is held by British Petroleum. One of those seats is held by DuPont. And the other two are appointees of the Bush administration. They're both Republican appointees.
Right.
And oddly enough, out of the 26 or 27 major projects, only three of them have been fully funded.
Yeah, and I mean, this, I guess the bigger issue here is I think these are things that most people don't even know. When they think about what government, what government does, they hear the individual stories like, oh, I guess there was some mess up with Vioxx. Oh, I guess, there was some mess up with this, with these Superfund sites that weren't cleaned up properly. But they're not individual stories. They're part of a pattern, and it's very hard to, get people to focus, on that larger story.
There's also a war on science at the elementary and secondary school level. It used to be the textbooks were published by a variety of companies all over the United States. Now it's a small handful of companies, mostly based in Texas. They have to be vetted by the Texas Board of Education in order to be sold nationally for all practical purposes. Is this part of why our high school graduates are not as science literate today as they were 30 years ago?
Well, I think there are. Look, I think there are a few things going on. I mean, there are the official things that happen in the textbooks, and there's also sort of a lot of cultural stuff that happens at the local level. I don't know what your education experience was growing up, but in my experience, I grew up in a comparatively kind of liberal upscale school, but even so, a lot of the big scientific issues of evolution or even medical ethics or genetic engineering, genetic testing, those were things that basically just never made it into the curriculum because the teachers didn't feel comfortable talking about it. They knew it was too controversial. They essentially omitted it. I mean, there's a lot of sin by omission, and
yeah. Yeah.
That's sort of a more pernicious kind of trend.
Yeah, and then it's a major problem. What decade were you in high school, Corey?
This was in the early 80s.
In the early 80s, yes. I went through high school in the 60s, and so it was actually quite different. But interesting. Corey Powell, Executive Director of Discover Magazine, discovermagazine.com, the website, and, of course, it's on the stands today, The State of Science. Corey, thanks for talking with us.
Hey, great to be here, and I hope it helps the dialogue.
Tom Hartmann Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you on Air America Radio. Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody's got to do it, and they're doing among the best of all of them out there. VAWatchdog.org, a great site if you are a veteran or anybody in your family is a veteran, which is a whole mess of us, and the extended families of all of us. Larry, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you again.
There is a story that may be apocryphal, I'm not sure, I suspect it's probably true, that Richard Nixon, when he first ran for Congress, did so because he answered a help wanted ad in a newspaper in Southern California that said, wanted a veteran willing to run for Republican House of Representatives, that the local Republican Party was advertising for a veteran. Used to be that being a vet was a big deal if you were running for political office. One of the articles on VAWatchdog.org pointing out that's not so much the case anymore.
No, as a matter of fact, the number of veterans who are now in Congress is at the lowest level since World War II. Ever since the draft ended near the end of the Vietnam War, the number of veterans who have been representing the United States on Capitol Hill has just gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. Veterans and their immediate families represent one-fourth of the population of the United States. 75 million people fall into that category. And veterans find this a very, very troublesome move. But without a draft, that's what we're finding. Fewer and fewer, and we're finding fewer sympathetic people toward veterans issues on Capitol Hill, as you might imagine, with this. There are only 129 members in the 110th Congress that have served in the military, and that includes reserves and National Guard. At one time, more than 50% of the members of Congress had served in the military, and it was almost a prerequisite. Just like
and this might also have something to do with why Congress seems to rubber stamp policies made by chicken hawks like Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Pearl and Feith and company. Stupid military actions. I mean, just patently stupid military actions because you don't have people who have combat experience in Congress anymore.
The sympathetic ears are dwindling, Tom. That is absolutely right.
Yeah.
And you to say that you have to have been there to understand the situation in the military and the situation of being a veteran might be a stretch of the facts, but it certainly does help. I know my 4 years in the military and in the regular United States Army give me an understanding of what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course what's happening now in the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, that I never would have been able to have had I not had that experience. So without those sympathetic ears, we are finding some bad military decisions and very bad decisions when it comes to VA healthcare and VA benefits.
What are the lead stories right now, Larry Scott, on VAWatchdog.org?
Well, right now we're waiting for the naming of the new VA secretary. That should come in the next couple of days, and it appears it's going to be the number two man at the VA, Gordon Mansfield. He's been there since 2001. Prior to that, he was head of the Paralyzed Veterans of America. He's looked on highly by most people, but he really hasn't done much in the 6 years he's been at the VA. And the real problem is, I think, if Mansfield is named for the last 15 months of this administration, Tom, we're going to have more of the same. Because as Nicholson went forward, which Secretary Nicholson, our current VA secretary, went forward and literally lied to Congress about the state of the budget, lied to Congress about withholding funds for mental health care, and many, many other problems, such as data breaches and data losses, Gordon Mansfield just sat there and nodded his head. So I really don't expect any dramatic moves or changes at the VA, but it looks like Gordon Mansfield will be named in the next few days to be the new VA secretary.
On the other hand, at least it won't be a crazy like John Bolton.
You know, I haven't thought of that. I wonder what Bolton could do to the VA if he got a hold of it.
God only knows. Why should we care about what's happening with Bob Filner?
We should care about that because Filner is a very powerful man, obviously, in the House. He is chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs.
He's a Democrat.
He is extremely pro-veteran. He has pushed through a lot of legislation that is favorable to veterans. However, he got into a problem last month at an airport in Washington, supposedly a pushing match with a United Airlines person over some baggage that hadn't arrived. They filed charges against him. These are criminal charges. And we just found out a few minutes ago an update of the story on the front page now. The House Ethics Committee has formed a special subcommittee to look into the charges against Representative Bob Filner. If any actions are taken against Filner because of this, or should he be convicted of the charges against him, and we'll find that out next month when he goes to court, this could be a serious blow to veterans. So that's why his precarious legal situation is important. This man is a true friend of veterans. It appears he made a mistake, lost his temper, did something he shouldn't have, and it could be costly not only to his career, but to the well-being of the House Veterans Committee in the short term and the long term.
But if you're a Republican senator from Louisiana and you get caught with a hooker, you get a standing ovation when you walk into the Senate.
Well, at least Bob Filner didn't do that.
Yeah, there you go. Larry Scott, founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. Great website. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Always good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. We'll be back with your calls and more. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, don't turn around. There's nothing here.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. I just want to share with you very quickly a Psalm of Life by Longfellow. Tell me not in mournful numbers that life is but an empty dream, for the soul is dead that slumbers and things are not what they seem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow find us farther than today. Art is long and time is fleeting, and our hearts, though stout and brave, still, like muffled drums, are beating funeral marches to the grave. In the world's broad field of battle, in the bivouac of life, be not like dumb, driven cattle. Be a hero in the strife. Trust no future, howe'er pleasant. Let the dead past bury its dead. Act! Act in the living present. Heart within and God o'erhead. Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime. And, departing, leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing, shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. My favorite poem. John in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, John, welcome to the program. You are on the air, John.
Oh, Tom?
Yes, sir. Yep.
I'm sorry. Boy, you've been hitting all my topics this morning. I'm a two-term Vietnam vet, a retired technology professional. The problem with science in this country is the money.
Yeah.
I was working on the ABM program when I was in my 20s. This started out as Nike Zeus in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still pouring billions of dollars into it today.
Sure. Yeah, the whole Star Wars thing, it's an absolute major disaster, and it's Dwight Eisenhower was so absolutely right. In fact, I'll share a clip of him with you in a few minutes, but good point, well made. Thank you very much. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey. Hey, Paula, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to clarify something about the nuclear option and what happened with that.
Sure.
It wasn't that the Republicans decided not to go nuclear. It was that a lousy deal was struck between the Gang of 14 or the so-called Gang of 14, a group
right.
of Republican and Democratic senators. And it was the worst deal ever, where essentially Republicans agreed not to pull the nuclear option if the Democrats agreed never to filibuster anything.
Yeah, essentially. Specifically Alito. But, yeah. Your point is, you're absolutely right, Paul, and thank you for clarifying that. This Dwight D. Eisenhower, President of the United States, speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 1953. This is the year after, this was the year, his first year as President of the United States. The President of the United States, my friends.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Dwight Eisenhower, President of the United States, just laying it out. Bill in Washington State. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, Tom, I'm real glad you didn't take my call right after you read that poem, because that would have been
terribly difficult to follow up on.
Yeah, Longfellow is extraordinary, and that's his best poem. And I've had a copy of that on the wall of my bedroom ever since I was a teenager.
Well, maybe you can put it up on the website so that we could put it out and put it up in some of our living spaces.
Yeah, it's easy to find. It's called A Psalm of Life, P-S-A-L-M, A Psalm of Life by Longfellow.
All right, well, I'll grab it. You were right about so much happening that it's got all of our heads spinning, and I just want to add one more piece into the fray. I'm not a Hillary fan. I do recognize, unfortunately, that since the fate of the Supreme Court for the rest of our lives kind of depends on a Democrat getting elected, that I'm not going to have a lot of choice. But I got to tell you, Tom, what I saw on this Hardball clip today just made me want to retch. The woman who's a co-founder of Code Pink, Medea
Benjamin. Yeah, Medea Benjamin.
Yeah, she claims that she was kicked out of a Hillary rally because she was wearing a T-shirt that basically said, bring troops home now. And her contention is that it was a group of goons, just like the Republicans have, who said, hey, you just can't be here if you're wearing or carrying anything that we haven't given you.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. Medea Benjamin is a friend of mine, and I can tell you I would absolutely trust what she says to be true.
Well, then, Tom, this is really serious, in my opinion. And I, you're the man with the mic. You're the man with the forum. Maybe we can make such a stink that Hillary understands that we're really looking for a change.
Well, let's keep in mind, Bill, just like the guy who got tasered at the John Kerry thing the other day, John Kerry had nothing to do with that. In fact, he was saying, hey, wait a minute, I want to answer this guy's question, and the cops went off on their own. I don't know the story yet. Apparently this just has recently happened. I haven't seen the news story on it. So let's withhold judgment about Hillary Clinton herself for a few minutes and find out, you know, who is responsible for this. But as I said, if Medea Benjamin said it, you can take it to the bank, in my opinion. Kevin in Sherwood, Oregon. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How's it going? I'm kind of off topic here, but I just wanted to find out what you knew about the possibilities of encouraging Texas to secede from the Union. I'm under the mistaken impression that they joined the Union via treaty and that they reserve the right to secede at any time.
That's the story the Texans will tell you. Texas and Vermont are the only two states that were independent republics before they joined the United States. And there's actually a strong secessionist movement in Vermont as well as in Texas. But it's largely just, you know, kind of a fringe thing and something that, I don't know about Texans, but Vermonters are kind of secretly proud of, but nobody takes seriously.
Yeah, which is too bad because I really think we should encourage us to go in that direction. I think it would probably solve a lot of our problems.
There you go.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot, Kevin. Ken in New York City. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
Okay. Progressives need a television network. We need to spend the money to get it. We need our guys with a few bucks to show leadership so that even little guys like me can buy a few shares and get in on getting a network back. We can't let the Murdochs and the Skates and the guys that run munition outfits run our free television network.
The problem, Ken, with, you know, I don't disagree that it would be a fine thing if a liberal, you know, if George Soros were to say that he's going to do exactly what Rupert Murdoch did and lose $100 million a year for 5 years, $500 million in order to
leadership to get us to.
Well, no, hang on just a second here. The Fox News lost $100 million a year for 5 years before they made $1 on Sean Hannity. They had lost $500 million before they made $1 on Hannity or on Blowhard, Bill O'Reilly or any of those guys. They lost a half a billion dollars. And, you know, yeah, it might be cool if George Soros or something were to do that. But frankly, I number one, I don't see it happening. And number two, the fact of the matter is that increasingly the positions that many of us, not all of us, but many of us in what's termed progressive talk radio are taking, and the positions that we stand for, are actually the traditional values of this country and are where the mainstream of America is at. And I believe, particularly with the success of people like Keith Olbermann, for example, on MSNBC, and now you see Dan Abrams kind of moving in that direction, and Dan always seemed to me like a real conservative Republican kind of guy, and he's, I think, the president of MSNBC. What we are seeing is that the right-wing crackpots, the Glenn Becks of the world, are being increasingly seen as right-wing crackpots. O'Reilly's ratings are starting to tank. And I think that, frankly, the marketplace is changing, is very much changing, and that you're going to see, quote, progressive programming, end quote, stop being called progressive, start being called mainstream, and you're going to see a breakout in both radio and television. And there's some good people out there in both areas, and in fact, there's even a couple of people on radio that I think could do really great television. So we'll see what time brings, but I have a feeling that as America leads, the media will follow, and America is becoming a far more progressive nation. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Thing, putting a radio guy on the radio. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9 minutes before the hour. And I want to call out Chris Matthews in a positive way. I, you know, give him my share of abuse, but congratulations, Chris. You had what I think is an extraordinary insight here. This was yesterday on Chris Matthews' program, Hardball. He was talking about the kid who was tasered, the John Kerry thing. And he says, I'm quoting Chris Matthews now. He says, democracy at gunpoint. I wonder if it's filtered back here at home. I wonder if it's drifting back home. The idea that democracy is something you do at gunpoint. Either you behave and do it this way and show up by putting your fingers in the ink and doing it this way, or you're an insurgent. Therefore, we can round you up, and if you resist, we can kill you. That notion, it's a bit fascist, and it's certainly a fascistic notion of democracy we're forcing on people over there. They didn't invite us into Iraq, and I wonder now whether we're picking up some of the bad habits of the war front. Good on you, Chris. I couldn't have said it better. I think it's a brilliant insight. And it's what, you know, back during the Vietnam War, what those of us in SDS and other peace organizations, anti-war organizations were saying, the war comes home. The war always comes home. And maybe it is now. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Pam in Santa Rosa, California on the line. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Tom?
Yes, Pam?
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thank you for waiting.
I have a story to relate. You had a caller earlier who spoke about Muslim churches in America praying for the death of Americans, and this sort of thing just has to stop. I was at a ceremony, a commemorative ceremony on Saturday for the National POW MIA Recognition Day, and it was not a political ceremony. It was to show support for our troops and to bring MIAs and POWs home and not to give up. The closing prayer was given by a local Baptist minister, and there was about 70 of us in the room. And he led us in prayer and proceeded to pray that Osama bin Laden and all of Al-Qaeda will die, at which point my eyes popped open, my hands unclasped. I will have nothing to do with praying for anybody to die. And I feel that is probably the most unchristian thing I have ever heard. And I don't see how these people who pray for people to die can even call themselves Christian.
Yeah. And Pam, I absolutely agree with you. And that is not a Christian thing to do, period. And you know, Jesus said, love your enemies, pray for those who despise you.
Yes, that's exactly what I told him. I said, Jesus said, love your enemies. And then he told me that they're going to follow us here. And I kind of chuckled at him.
Man.
And he said, well, Al-Qaeda, because of people like you, Al-Qaeda will come over here, and they will more than gladly, slowly decapitate your husband.
Yeah. Pam,
this is a Baptist minister.
I know. This is a guy who's living in terror. This is a guy who has been terrorized by the Republicans and by the Bushies, and, you know, we need to, you know, have some empathy for him and feel sorry for him and hopefully wake him up and say to him, and people like him, quit being a wimp, quit being afraid, quit being terrified. It's time, particularly if you call yourself a Christian, trust in God, trust in your faith, trust in the strength of this nation. If you believe in democracy, trust in the strength of democracy, of the memes and of the ideas that are put forward. They ultimately will triumph, and being afraid and praying for the death of other people ain't the way to do it. Pam, well said. Thank you very much for sharing that experience with us. Fisk in Mill Valley, California. Am I pronouncing it right, Fisk?
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I just wanted to
I already say said that. I'll get better, so I'm not going to say it again.
I just wanted to comment on Stephanie and what she was talking about with Germany. My mom was born. She just turned 90 on September 10th, and she was born and she lived all through Nazi Germany. And you know, she voted for Nixon, and you know, she kind of establishes the same patterns. And I'm just wondering if you know, most Americans are following in the same patterns just because the power of the media is so strong. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing, and you know, Pam, just your previous caller just said a really great thing, you know, that really what we have to do is it has to be all about love, and that's really what it all comes down to.
Yeah, it is the greatest power in the universe, Fisk, is love. It really and truly is. Dan, and thank you for the call. Dan in San Diego, about a half a minute here, Dan, before
we wrap up
the show.
Yeah, I guess I'm sort of going to be the dark cloud in front of the silver lining you mentioned about Chris Matthews.
Okay.
Yeah, he's, like the conservatives, they're making a big issue of this because it's Kerry, a Democrat, but when George Bush did the same thing and worse, they never mention it, so.
Well, occasionally it got called out, and as I said, you know, I've jumped all over Chris Matthews more than once, but I think that his comment was I was just struck by it. It was just something that frankly hadn't even occurred to me that it's a brilliant insight that tasering this kid at the Kerry thing is, you know, that the police would think that this is an appropriate thing to do because we have become so hyper-militarized because we've been living in fear and terror for 6 years, a fear and terror inflicted upon us by these right-wingers. Coming up tomorrow, Scott Thumma is going to be on about his book on megachurches. We'll have an interesting debate or discussion. Naomi Klein is here on Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, her new book, and Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress, and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.